basically, that's what we have to understand in Rashi. First of all, how does Rashi know that the reverse is true? And secondly, even if it is true, what does it have to do with perfection? Leslie's saying that people have an idea. Generally, people think that somebody who's intelligent is reflective. So that's why Shlomo HaMelech says that if you want to look intelligent, so act like you're reflective. Don't talk. And people will think that you're very intelligent. It's possible. It's possible to explain the pasuk that way. It certainly is possible. But it would also explain the reverse. But it would leave... In other words, what you're saying is even if you're chacham, but if you answer right away, even if you say chachmas, people won't really consider you wise because you don't give the appearance of being a reflective individual. So, fine. But the question that would still remain is what does that have to do with perfection? In other words, so what? So if you want to fool people, so it's a good way to fool people. But what does that have to do with lematzasi? Kol yomai gadalti bein hachachamim v'lamatzasi l'guf tov meshika doesn't seem to imply that he's trying to teach you a way how to appear as intelligent when you're not. Right. The thing is like this. It's an interesting phenomenon. But there are certain times that people themselves, even though they aren't learned, still have a perception of a true idea. And they may not be able to formulate it properly, but they can perceive what is correct. You see? Another pasuk. It's a pasuk that says, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, V'shem Yerushalayim Yirakev. So you see that the tzaddik is remembered for the good, and that means not just by tzaddikim, it means even by the masses of people. And Shem Rasham Yerakev, in the name of the wicked is should rot. So what's the pshat? That the average person, does the average person know? The answer is that down deep, the average person does know some things. There's a part of man that can't perceive certain things, and even though at the time that the Russia is in power, he'll have a large following. And the time the tzaddik is alive, he may have a lot of people that are against him. But eventually, people will recognize the true character of the individuals. Why? Because there is a part of man that is in line with reality. So while this part is not necessarily in the foreground all the time, but it does occasionally emerge. That's an interesting phenomenon. Now, the question we have to ask with regard to Mishlei is precisely why does Mishlei himself concern himself with the... All right, Mishlei, you could say, is a bit political. But it's political, so it could be Mishlei's giving advice. That's possible. But Rashi didn't perceive it that way. See, Rashi didn't think that the pasuk in Mishlei is giving you advice on how to look like a chacham. Rashi thought rather that the pasuk in Mishlei is one of those cases where people can intuitively know what the truth is. So when the pasuk says evel chacham, machresh, is chacham yachashev, so what the pasuk is saying is that people evaluate a person that way, there is a good grounds for it. Good grounds for it. People can sense many times their own imperfections. They can sense their weaknesses. They may not be able to overcome them, but they can sense their weaknesses because they're in tune with their emotions to a certain degree, in a certain way, and therefore they can sense what imperfection is and what perfection is. Okay?
How do they know that?
It's a certain intuition. Everybody should want to be a tzaddik. But Zecher Tzadik Livracha only works later. Why does it only work later? Because somehow or other people could sense it. But not enough to make it a current phenomena. In the past, he was a tzaddik. But now you have the same exact problem again. But in this situation, the same emotions arise again, and the and the evil will prevail. But the tzaddik from the past will be recognized. There is such a thing in man that he can recognize reality. He is aware of his weaknesses. He has a certain awareness of his weaknesses in a certain way. Sometimes this is this way is enough to have a true idea come through. Now, the thing is like this. Why is it really that Evel Machresh Chacham Yechashiv? See, Rashi was bothered. Why is that so? So Rashi held like this. That the Evel Machresh is Chacham Yechashiv. People think he's wise, not because he's portraying an image of a reticent, pondering individual. That's not why. More to it than that. That's first sight, that would seem to be the reason. More to it than that. See, people recognize that a chacham is a person whose energy is directed towards the ideas. They recognize this. And as subjective as people may be, they know that really objectivity is the highest level. They know that. And you can hear from the daily conversations. They'll say, well, he's personally involved, isn't it? Of course, they themselves are personally involved. Even when they decide who's personally involved. But the thing is that they know that there is a certain state which is necessary, an objective state which is necessary for coming to the truth. Now the thing is like this, that people recognize that the only way that a person could really hope to come to the true conclusion is through being concerned primarily and essentially only with the phenomena that exist and nothing else. Now, people recognize also that when you get together and a question is raised, everybody's jumping to give the answer. Now, people recognize the reason why everybody is trying to give the answer is not because they are overly concerned with the phenomena. See? But rather is a certain instinctive reaction that there's instinctive pressure that they're operating under. And that pressure basically is a certain social concern to demonstrate to others how great the chachma is. They're not so much concerned with solving the problem per se, but they're really concerned with demonstrating their great wisdom. Now, everybody really is involved in this to some degree. So, and people can sense this. Now, even though you would have a group of people and all will respond at the same time, let's say, all be the same, but each one really recognizes underneath that there is some emotion involved there. Of course, they negate it, but they won't really analyze it. But they sense that there's something here. Then when they see somebody that's quiet, that's machresh, that's quiet and is thinking over the situation, they consider him a chacham because they recognize that this man is really looking into the truth of the situation. They sense that. The reason why people think that he's a chacham is because they sense their own shortcomings. And they could see that this person is not involved in the same thing that they're involved in. And they sense this. It's like an intuitive thing. Because the person is somehow or other aware of his own shortcomings in a certain way. It's not completely... If a person was completely unaware of his shortcomings, there would never be a mitzvah of tshuva. It's impossible to do tshuva because he has no awareness whatsoever. The fact that you see the Torah says that a person has to do tshuva shows you there must be some awareness of his weaknesses. Of course, it's a very vague type of thing. It's not really clear, but nevertheless it's there. And therefore what happens is like this. People are aware that the reason why, most of the time, the reason why they're jumping to give the advice is not because they really found the solution, they're so happy to find the solution, but rather because they want to be in a certain capacity. So if they see somebody that's quiet, that's machrish, so they think... They many times, as a matter of fact, they project onto that individual that he's really the chacham. He's really concerned with the problem. So that's why Rashi says the reverse is true also. Why is there the reverse is true also? Even a chacham, a person is wise, but if he's always jumping to give advice at every opportunity, so he will be considered a fool. Why will he be considered a fool? Even if it's good advice. Because people sense that he's really emotionally involved. They can sense that. And once they sense he's emotionally involved, no matter how good the advice is, they're not going to listen to him anymore. So that's why Rashi says that it works both ways. Works both ways. See, the Rav one time said about the Brisker Rav, his uncle, that he only came out three times, I think it was, protesting against the certain anti-religious movements that were taking place in Eretz Israel. He said, why only three times? He says, there were many other issues. But he never said a word about those other issues. Why? Because he knew that if he protest on every issue, nobody would listen to him. See? And he saved his power for those times when he felt it was impossible. Now, this is time. This is a crisis. Now I have to say something. And there were many situations that came up in Eretz Yisrael which were really against halacha. Against halacha. But he didn't say anything. He knew he'd lose his credibility. That's the ration. That's the puzzle. So what does this have to do with perfection, really? What does this have to do with perfection? The answer is very simple. The answer is that not only is it something which is true politically, but as we said, the reason why it's true politically is because people sense and people are aware of this phenomena. They're aware of their own weaknesses, and they can readily see it in others. And as soon as they see the weakness, that's it. They're not going to listen anymore. So it is based on something real. It's not just that people think that way, and you should try to fool them. But it's based on a reality. And the reality is that a person who is involved in, who is under the sway of the emotion, under the sway of the emotion to respond immediately and to give advice, he's under that's the emotion that's driving him, will really not give very good advice, will not really be a chacham, will not be a chacham, because he's not really concerned with the reality. So that's why he says, Kol yom gadalti ben achamul amatzas l'gufta v'mishika. He said that that among the chachamim he saw that there was one thing that they were very careful about. And they were very careful about being sure that whenever something arose, they never allowed their emotions to get involved, but they simply looked at the situation per se, at the ideas themselves. Yeah, that people have a way of sensing certain things, certain imperfections, is true. I mean, it's true. It's mentioned in Rashi here, but actually in the secular world, it wasn't really till relatively recently that such an idea found its way into psychology, that people can sense other people's shortcomings without really defining them logically, but that there is a certain machinery that a person has through which he can detect certain flaws in other people in an unconscious way. They call it reading another person's unconscious. And many times, if a person wishes to perfect himself, he sees that people saying things about him that aren't just, sometimes worthwhile to see if in fact they really did pick up a flaw in his character. Sometimes that's the way it is. Sometimes it's true. But there is such an ability among human beings. How the Rambam learns this Maimar. Very lengthy explanation here. Very lengthy explanation. Is what the idea is. Many of the Bali Musa have always emphasized the concept of Dvarim B'Tehillim. Dvarim B'Tehillim means just to speak ordinary things. And, I mean, they've emphasized that it's a terrible thing. I mean, it's brought down in, and Kabbalah also is brought down. Dvar Metelim is one of the worst of errors. Terrible thing. Something at first sight which a person doesn't really understand. What do you mean it's such a terrible thing? And in many Musa yeshivas, what they would do is people would take upon themselves what they call a tainas divor. Tainas divor. Fasting with regard to speech. And they wouldn't, they would try not to speak Dvarim Batalim. And Dvarim Batalim became a very big, a very big issue in terms of self-perfection and Musa. Sometimes to the point where an outsider would, who didn't know what they were doing would think it's absurd. The Chazal properly, so many times a person can try to do certain things which, due to the fact that he doesn't have a good concept of what's going on, can be harmful, even though it looks like he's in line with what Chazal said. So the only way he could know how to act with regard to such a thing is by understanding what the ideas are. Okay, the Ram goes through the length. It says, Kfar Omar Chacham Barov Dvarim LaYechdal Pesha. So he quotes Mishlei says that if there's a lot of speech, then there always will be a sin. There always will be sin. The Tama Dover, what's the reason? Most of the words are really extra and are sinful. And that's like this. When a person speaks a lot, he definitely sins. The same thing, like the Chum say later, that the person should make a siyag for chachma, should make a fence around himself in order to be wise, and that is shtika, keeping quiet. Now he says, V'ribuy advarim misimone aksilim. Then he goes on, he says that, first of all, he says it brings to chait, because it's impossible, he says that certainly, l'fi shevada yeh b'dvarav l'pachos mila achas she'ena ruri lama. Definitely there will be at least one word that's not fit to be said. The Rambam says, and since that one word is not fit to be said, so it's an avera. And if he speaks a lot, he's going to eventually get there. That word's going to come out. All right. Well, when you see this Rambam at first, say, well, I mean, not his fault. You know, one word came out. What's the terrible? It sounds like going to extreme. You know, so he speaks a lot, and one bad word is going to come out sooner or later. So what? So he said a word that's not so good, but he didn't intend to do it. It would seem that the Rambam's going, being too hard on the person. He says like this. Now he goes further. He says, "Ukvar Amar Chacham, wise people said, Ki miyut hadibur mara al kavar mishpacha, vayesad miyuchas. Amru miyachsusa shtikusa." And the Chacham say that had they used to know which families are really considered the better families for a person to marry into, they say the ones, the sign was shtikusa. They don't talk much. Quiet people. Nicely, yes. Amru b'sefer Amidos. It says in one of the books, in one of the books that deal with ethics, it's one of the Arabic books that deal with ethics. We don't know exactly which book it was. But anyways, this is the Rambam quotes from that book, the book of ethics that was extant in his time. It says like this, She'echor ha-chachomim, one of the wise men that used to was so silent that he only spoke very little. And they asked him, they said, why are you so silent? So he said like this, said, I investigated the area of speech and I found that it was divided into four parts. Anything a person speaks can be divided into four parts. The first part is speech which is completely harmful, without any benefit at all. He says that would be like speaking against people, cursing people, aggressive talk, or divrei nevola, something that has to do with lewd speech. He says this is certainly, everybody knows that this is definitely shtus, waste of time, bad, even worse than just waste of time. V'chelek hasheni, in the second category of speech, dibur sheyesh bo nezek mitzad echad v'toelas mitzad achad. It's a different kind of speech which on the one hand is beneficial, on the other hand it's harmful. Kigon l'shabeach odom kidei lehonos mimenu. V'yiyeh ba'oso ha'shevach ma'ashem margiz esono. V'nimtza mazik l'zeh she'shivcho. L'fikach tzorach lachdom mizeh beglal zeh v'lo l'daber gam b'chelak hazeh ma'adibah. Okay. Then he says, then it has to do with, if you want, praising somebody, flattery. So it says, flattering somebody could be harmful. Why? Because if you flatter one person because you want to gain some benefit from him, so there are other people that that are there, that are present, and they dislike him. And the moment you praise him, so they hate him. So while praising him, maybe... may be considered a good thing because, oh, you're praising him, so he's happy, you're making him happy. So it's nice to make him happy. But simultaneously, you're harming him. Why? Because there are other people, if you praise him privately, all right, that's fine. But since you are in a position where you have to praise him, and you praise him publicly, there are other people that hate him, and because they hate him, they're going to harm him. They will harm him. Okay, so therefore, you're harming this individual. Now he says, that's the second type of speech, second category. Now he says the third category is where a person... Yeah. Where it's... This Chacham doesn't seem to say, and Ram Kosen say that it's bad to praise somebody because you want to gain something from him. And basically, you should say that that's deceitful. Bad is deceitful. And you're lying. So what's the answer? The answer is that, of course, if the praise is false, there's no question about it, that it's a lie, it's false. Then it would belong to the sheker, belong to the first category. But it's speaking where the particular praise that you're mentioning happens to be true. So in that case, there really is no harm in praising him. Because you're telling him something that's true, and you're making him feel good. So on the contrary, it's a mitzvah. But the only thing is that if it's... So then there's another question. So why doesn't he say that it's not good to praise a person in general? Because somebody else will hear that hates him. Why does he have to say... where you praise the person because you want to gain something from it? Why does he mention that? Why does he just say that it's wrong to praise the person in general? Because if you praise the person, it's going to cause him harm. You know what I mean? Why does he say because you... doesn't seem to say, in other words, that it's bad per se to praise somebody because you want to you want a favor from them. Doesn't seem to say it's bad. And what is bad that you're going to cause him harm? So if that's the case, why doesn't he just say it's bad to praise a person in general? Why does he say because you want to gain something from him? That's when it's bad. In other words, like this. You see, apparently what he means is, he means a political situation. See, ordinarily you wouldn't praise him. Because ordinarily you would realize that it's not to his advantage to praise him. But the only reason that you're praising him is because you're in a political situation. Now, in this political situation of praising him, so you have to praise him in front of others because that's the very nature of the situation. Since you want to gain something from him, so what you have to do is you must praise him in front of other people because that's where it's not speaking personally where you praise him personally. We must praise him in front of others because that's precisely that's precisely what he wants. You see, that's precisely what he wants. Then you're going to be causing him. Then you're going to be causing him harm. Otherwise, in other words, there would be no reason. Like this. See, he means like this, that if it wouldn't be that you are going to if it wouldn't be a political purpose here, it would just be you want to praise the person, so you just go over to him. Tell him how nice he is. So why do you have to praise him in public? The answer is because, on the contrary, it should be something which would be a private thing, not a public thing. But the reason why you're doing it in public is because you want to give him a certain situation of honor. And honor is only where it's in public. Right? So, therefore, now why do you want to give him that situation? Why do you want to give him? It's not, in other words, you're not interested. If a person is wants to express his opinion about somebody, so then he wouldn't do it publicly. Do it privately. Why publicly? Publicly is only one possible motivation, because he wants to confer a certain benefit on this individual. He's not interested in just telling him about his, praising him, notifying him on how great he is. But he wants to confer upon him the benefit of having others recognize how great he is. See, now that a person wouldn't do unless he had some type of ulterior motive. So therefore, that a person wouldn't do unless he had some type of ulterior motive. Why should he do this? What? Why? Why should he want to honor him? Because the Ram says, V'yeh bosa shevach mashem margiz asono. The nimsa mazik was esh shivcha. So in other words, that there's something in the shevach which is harmful to the enemy. Yeah. That's a good job. In other words, yeah. Question is, why does he have to say only that it'll lead to harm? If it's a flattering situation, why does he mention it'll lead to harm? Because somebody else, you'll be praising him, and you'll include in the praise something that's that somebody else won't like. I mean, find out that there's an ulterior motive. Offhand, I would say that this type of speech in general is bad. To flatter somebody because you want to gain something from them is a very dangerous type of speech, because you're in a situation where you're liable to. I mean, why does he mention the harm is that the harm is that somebody else might not like precisely the way you praise them? Yeah, okay, that's a secondary thing. But what about harming him by telling him false ideas, false things, and conveying false impressions? I would think that would be a more immediate danger. She really is. His whole approach is a difficult approach. And why doesn't he say that? In general, this is a bad thing to try to flatter somebody. To be concerned with this chacham, what he seems to be concerned with is the benefits and the damage that can result to other people from your speech. That's what he seems to be going around. He seems to be revolving around that issue. That's why I said the first one is when you curse somebody. That's definitely a damager. You see? Or the second case is where you do an action which has both, which has benefit and has damage also. And why he breaks it up that way is difficult to understand. I would think that he should break it up in terms of perfection. You know what I mean? Something which is dibur. The first category should be dibur, which is bad for the person himself to say. And the second one, that there's some benefit in speech, and there isn't any benefit. But he seems to be dealing with regard to others, how others are affected. Although in the first category he mentions divrei nevola. Right, a little bit. Alright, the third category. Chelak Ashlishi is Dibur She'im Bo To'ela Shelo Nezek. He says that speech where there is no benefit and there is no loss. Kigon Rov Sipurei Ha'amon, like most of the stories of the masses. Heyach Nivnis Choma Sa'ir, how the walls of the city were built. Heyach Nivna Armon Ploni. V'tir Yofi Bayis Ploni. V'shefa Peres Medina Ploni. K'yotza B'zem Advarim She'im Achlamosa. He says, these are just things that are irrelevant. Amar kigama dibur b'chela gazem miyusar v'ein botela. So he said, this is extra, and there is no benefit.
Yeah, but there's no
honor. But he calls it, yeah, it's true. I mean, he's right. And Les is right. So there's no, it's miyusar, it's extra, so what's wrong? He doesn't seem to say. He says, it's miyusar, it's extra, v'ein botela, so there's no benefit. V'achela karvi, the fourth chelek, is heim devarim shekulam toelas. These are things which have a total benefit. Speaking about sciences and about ethical values. The dibur adam bin yonim hanogim lo mimashi yeshbo kim chiyuso vasmoras mitziyuso. And speaking about things that are related to a person's being able to survive, to live, to make a living, to continue his existence. Ubozer roi ledaber, and this is fitting for a person to speak. Amar kol zman shani shomei adavar. So this chacham says, whenever I hear something, ani bochanav, I test it, I analyze it. If I find that it's from this fourth category, then I speak about it. And if it was from the rest of the other three categories, shasakti mimeno, then I kept quiet. That's what the Chacham answered. So he says, Amru, they said, Amr Bali Hamidos, those who have knowledge of ethics, said, Hisbonein Ba'adam Azeh, think into this man, V'chachmaso, on his wisdom, Shehishmit Shloshes Rivei Advarim, that he omitted three quarters of this of speech. V'zu Chachma Sheroi L'Snaigbo, and this is Chachma that is befitting for a person to live according with. Living according with. That's the round. Okay? Level. So therefore, the Rambam advises that a person should live that way. Sounds like exereshenu rev tibuchan lamad by the Gemara. I mean, people walk. Well, why should you give such advice to people? No, nobody can do it.
The Rambam would
say, "Oh, yeah." Of speech. How would you break down the four categories of speech? I think we could answer the question we raised about the second category, about the flattering. Why, if we understand what the breakdown of the four categories are. The breakdown of the four categories are like this. And you have to understand, before you understand the breakdown of the four categories, however, you have to understand one more principle. What is the whole idea behind this Rambam? It sounds funny. I mean, to make such a suggestion, nobody listens to such suggestions, nobody can do it. And also, why is the third category so bad? Like Mr. Marsh, I guess. I mean, so what? Make a joke, such a terrible thing. I mean, because the only things he says that have toelis, he only mentions if it's science, if it's knowledge of ethics, or if it's business, or something that's important to sustain the life of the individual. Everything else he seems to say is he doesn't speak about. So I can understand the first chelik he shouldn't talk about, first category, second category. But the third, what's so bad about the third? What if a person reads a little story or whatever, or talks about things that don't make any difference? What's so bad about it?
You can go either way.
One that we mentioned a while back. That the thing is that the Vayi Adam L'Ruach M'Malala, that in man, his instinctual energy is diverted into speech. That's really, see, a person's instinctual forces do not express themselves in action so much as in speech. Tremendous amount of instinctual energy is directed towards speech, because man is different than the animal. He's different than the animal is that he sublimates. And he sublimates, by sublimating, what he does is he directs his energy into the area of speech. Now, that's why the Rambam says that these Chazal say, Kol yomav gadalte ben hachamu lamatzas leguf tov meshtika. What does it mean, lamatzas? This is the most important thing. Shtika. Why? Because, he explains, that this chacham that he mentions had an interesting view. He maintained that the area, essentially, there are two areas that the that a person's instincts drive him to. One is the aggressive, see, and the other is the sexual. Those two areas. Now it seems he maintained that he does mention the sexual, because he says that divrei nevala. But essentially, he maintains that in man, it's the aggressive that his energies go to. Essentially. That's why he breaks it down to these categories. See, the first category, he says, is things sheyesh b'hem nezek. Yesh b'hem nezek means where man is expressing his aggressive drive. That's like cursing somebody. It's an expression of the aggressive drive, direct expression of the aggressive drive through speech.
Yeah.
The second case, he says, in the second case, it's really a combination. It's a combination. A person is trying to be beneficial, and yet simultaneously he's aggressive. And he gives an interesting example. The example is like this, that he's praising somebody because he wants to gain a benefit from him. See? Now, since he wants to gain a benefit from him, so he praises him. Now, what's the objective of his praise? The objective of his praise is to benefit this individual. Isn't that true? But actually, he says that included in his objective is the fact that he's harming the same individual. Simultaneously. Because he knows very well that the certain things that he's saying is going to arouse the anger of others that are present also. So that's going to be causing a harm. And at the time he realizes that he's causing this person harm. But he simply doesn't care. Because his objective is really for the gain. So he simply is not concerned. In other words, man's aggression can take two roads. One is where the aggression is direct, simply has direct aggression to somebody, but then there is also a hidden type of aggression that a person has. The hidden type of aggression is where he's trying to praise the person, but he realizes that there's certain harm that's going to eventuate from this situation. And he knows about it. But, I mean, it's important that he accomplishes his purpose, and therefore he overlooks it, you see. That's why he doesn't say, he doesn't speak where if you flatter a person improperly, you'll be telling him lies maybe or false things. Because that's not a situation where you're really showing the aggressive drive. Because if he lies to him, it's not really the aggressive drive. He doesn't intend to harm him. Nobody intends to harm another person by making him think highly of himself. See? He doesn't say to himself, I'm going to harm that person's soul, because now he'll think highly of himself, and therefore he's going to have a wrong opinion of himself, he's not going to be on a high level. You know, I mean, nobody would do that, because if that was the world of reality for him, so then he wouldn't be doing this to begin with. You understand what I mean? The aggressive drive doesn't express itself in a spiritual way. A person doesn't set out to harm his friend in a spiritual way. And nobody in their right mind would do something like that. To say, I'm going to try to take mitzvahs away from this person, so that his neshama will not have a very high chelak in olam haba. I've never heard of any type of an individual who would want to do something like that. I mean, it's ridiculous, because if he maintains that really the true world is the world of the neshama, so then why is he doing this to begin with? Obviously, the only aggression can only be, you can only try to harm somebody in a physical, materialistic way. It's impossible for a person to try to harm somebody in a spiritual way.
I give him the wrong ideas.
The wrong ideas,
yeah,
because because he wants this person's soul to be destroyed, so he wants to give him the wrong ideas. You ever heard of that? See? But you see that nobody really is aggressive towards another person in a spiritual way. That is an impossibility.
Because
people would really do that. If people would really be concerned with another person's soul, you'd have very little friction in society. If every time somebody did harm to you, you would say, look, let him, I'm not going to correct him, because let him stay with his distorted soul, with his corrupt soul, so he'll really suffer a true evil. See? If that would be the case, you wouldn't have any need for any courts or anything. But you have a different kind of society. But people aren't aggressive that way. Why, Rabbius, why is it? The reason why it's impossible is very simple. Because if a person was on the level where the only reality to him was the true world of ideas, that was the only reality, so then he would never have a desire to harm somebody. See, I mean, that's why it's an impossibility. He wouldn't be... Anyone who's under the influence of that emotion, that he enjoys seeing somebody else destroyed, is obviously not on the level, not on a high philosophical level. So therefore, there can never be such a combination where a person wants to destroy somebody else philosophically.
Can you understand your views, Robbie?
Harm the other person, he's not going to get any satisfaction out of the fact that the person loses a part of his olam haba. I mean, it's ridiculous. The satisfaction that he wants is he wants to see the person suffer a material loss. Not a loss, a
spiritual
loss. What is he going to gain from that? It's impossible. Why this Chacham did not give as an example the case where you flatter somebody and you flatter him, you flatter him untruthfully. Because even if you should say it's true, you would be harming that person by giving him a false image of himself. And it is true that most of the time, flattery is nothing more than that. But it's not your intention to harm him that way. You're not intending to harm him. So it's not really a case where you're showing me, where you're demonstrating to me that the aggressive instinct is being expressed. It's not the aggressive instinct, because we have to speak in terms of the instinct. However, he says, there is a case where the aggressive instinct is released, but in a subtle way, an indirect way. And that is the second case. The second case is where you intend to pray somebody for his benefit. And you know very well that the things that you're saying are also going to cause him harm. But sort of your mind sort of slips over it. And, you don't want to dwell on it. You're not really concerned. But it's not something that you are intentionally concentrating on. Now, why he breaks it down into two categories is very simple. Because what he's saying is that these are two different psychological phenomena. In other words, the first case is a psychological phenomena where a person intentionally wants to do another overt harm. That's one manifestation of the aggressive instinct in man. But, this Chacham says, there's another manifestation of the aggressive instinct in man, a very subtle one. And man's nature is very devious. So it's not just all or nothing. But sometimes a person can, parenthetically, harm another individual. It's like a side thought. It's like the attention of his mind is not really focusing on it, but there is some type of mental awareness about it. It's sort of like a subconscious type of aggression. So actually what this Chacham, why did he break it up into two categories, was because he wanted to show the two types of aggression in man. One is clear, overt, intentional aggression, and the other is a subconscious type of aggression. That's the second category. See? The second category usually comes along with the case, has to actually come along with the case where you're benefiting the other person also. Because that's why it's subconscious. Because the harm gets lost in the benefit, in the person's mind. So the benefit is really a matir. It gives him a license to harm the person in a subconscious way. That's why you have those two categories. Okay? Yes. What? Amazing thing how you see how they were aware of subconscious types of phenomena, mental phenomena. And they recognized it as being a very... It's not just... See, most people are aware of subconscious phenomena. But he recognized it as an important trend in a person's nature. It's a trend. In other words, what happens is like this. If a person is overtly aggressive, so he releases aggression in that way. But usually, the average person can't be so aggressive openly. So what happens to his aggression is it gets concealed and expressed and alongside a beneficial thing where he can rationalize to himself, I'm benefiting the man. And that's it. It's a rationalization. But it's a trend and it's a way of life. And it's a manner of operation. It's the way people's minds, people's psyche function. That's why he said that's why he mentioned the second category. It's a category. He recognized that it's not just an isolated event. When you first read that case, figure it's an isolated event. You know, a person is praising somebody. How often does that happen? It's not an isolated. He's showing you that there is a type of mental phenomena that is subconsciously aggressive. Okay? Now, third category. The third category, he says, doesn't have any benefit and no harm. However, he maintained that a person should avoid that category also. Why should a person avoid that category? I mean, it's not conscious harm, it's not subconscious harm. I mean, why should he avoid that category? What's the answer?
There is, because just like speech is a means for the instinctual, and speech is something which man usually, I mean, gets out his instinctual forces through speaking rather than through action, rather than through physical action, so too is speech a means for a person for something else. It's a means for the highest form of expression. And that is the human mind, human thought. That's the highest level of the human of activity in man. And it's there the human being really comes in contact with the Tzelem Elokim, that he uses the Tzelem Elokim that was given to him. And that really is where he relates to, he acts in a godly way. He has a relationship with God, like the Rambam expresses in the Mara. That's the only time he has a relationship with God, the Rambam says. When he uses that higher faculty to appreciate the endless chachma of God. So, just like speech can be used for man's instinctual outlet, it can also be used for the highest expression that is possible. That's Chachmas Elokim. So what he says, and also Chachmas Elokim, and also that which is necessary to sustain the person. Why? Because in order to sustain himself per se, but to sustain himself so that he can be involved in Chachma. Now that's why he omitted the third category. This Chacham omitted the third category for a simple reason. Because he didn't want any of the energy to be lost that could be directed towards Chacham. But it's an interesting thing. You see, that's why there's a Chazal that the Rambam quotes later. I'm sorry, it's not the Rambam. Actually, it's the Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah quotes a Chazal. He says like this. He says, the Yerushalmi, Amar Rav Shimon ben Lakish. Rav Lakish said, Ilu Avi. Why? So, why would he ask the two men? It's very simple. Because he recognized the fact that it's a strange phenomena. But the same instrument that can be used in man for the instinctual can also be used for the highest chachma. It's an unusual phenomena. When he perceived, or Rish Lakish perceived how strange it is that the that one object should be the vehicle of those two different worlds, so he said, if I was there, I would ask for two. But then it says, Hadarama. Later he changed his mind. What did he say? He said, on the contrary, Hashta de Leslan Elachad, now that I have only one, Lo Yachil Nalameitzel Nafshin Milishna Bisha, I can't save myself from Lashon Hara. Kol Shkini Havelon Train. Certainly if we had two. What's the shot? Why will I talk more Lashon Hara if I had two?
What's that?
See, think like this. What he's saying is, what? Is in a way, but even more than that. It's true. But it's not just quantitatively. The thing is like this, that if there were two separate vehicles, so then the person would never really, he would, in other words, he would have a designation for aggressive, if there were two separate vehicles, then, exactly. In other words, like this, his question was, it's strange that you should have the same vehicle to express two different things, the low instinctual and also the highest reality. So he says, no, but that's precisely why it was that way. Because if God would have given two mouths, it would mean that there would be a designation for a vehicle of evil, you see, and one of good, then nothing would stop that vehicle of evil from functioning. Because once it would be designated, then it would function. Exactly. It'd be like a matter. Because this is designated for evil. That's it. But now that he knows that he only has one, you see, there is no designation. Now there's a chance. Even though now he's also a La Yachim and Lemesh Levi Yerushim. But at least there's a chance. In the beginning, he was thinking not in terms of function, but in terms of how the ideas of creation should really be presented.
You know, how she, what's what? How logically she constructed? Logically, it's two different things. How can you have the same vehicle? Then he said, no, the reason why God did it was because functionally the other way would be worse. So even though conceptually it would make more sense that man should be constructed that way, but functionally it would be more corrupting for him. That's the Gemara. But that follows naturally from the way the Chacham has his categories worked out. Why does he include business and learning in the same category? Well, it's true. Rabbi Mann mentions that the Avos did it he's doing Shem Shemayim, which means a very mysterious word. But he's doing it for the purpose of being able to learn. So he eats in order to be able to learn. Yeah, that may be true, but it's still only a means. It's still only a means. It's not really the ultimate. The category of beneficial, it's true. As far as the category of beneficial, it's true. That definitely belongs in the category of the beneficial. He isn't talking about just the business over here. The category is, he says, V'dibor adam b'nyanim anogim lo mamish sheyesh bo kiyum chiyuso v'asmaras mitzuyuso. Which means, and he says, well, he translates like this, b'mashehu miyuchad bo min advarim shechayov teluyim bohem. Those things which life depends upon. So it's only insofar as it's absolute necessity. He's not talking about business where a person has his needs and goes beyond that point. That certainly is not a philosopher's type of activity. So he's speaking about only that which is absolutely necessary. Yeah. The question still is, it's only a means, and there should be more of a differentiation. He doesn't seem to, and even if you say, it's true, that Heshy said that made a good point, because it has to be in the fourth category. Which other category would you put it in? That's true. But it doesn't bother me so much that it's in the fourth category. Fine. But he doesn't seem to be. If you look at his lashon, he seems to like run straight through. Achelik aviyehem advarim shekulam toeles kigon adibur b'madoyim ubimalos v'dibur adam binyanim hanogim lo mamish mashiyesh bo kim chiyusof. He seems to like put it into sort of like one. Yeah, he doesn't seem to make much of a distinction. Not as much as the other ones, but it's a means for this also belongs under this category. Fine, a subcase, whatever subcategory. Seems to say that it's one thing, yeah. Well, the end of the Mora is on man's perfection. Around towards the end of the Mora, he has a chapter on man's perfection. And it's the last chapter, actually. Now he says like this. He says that there are four levels of perfection. He says the first kind, the lowest, is in the acquisition of which people spend their days. Is perfection, he says the first kind, the lowest, in the acquisition of which people spend their days, in other words, most people, is perfection as regards property. The possession of money, garments, furniture, servants, land, and the like. The possession of the title of a great king belongs to this class. In other words, honor also. There is no, now he says like this. He says, There is no close connection between this possession and its possessor. You'll notice the Rambam doesn't say that it's wrong, but the Rambam says it's considered the lowest level of perfection, but it's a perfection. It's an interesting thing. The Rambam considers it a perfection. In other words, a person's financial state is considered a perfection, but it's considered the first level, the lowest level of perfection. Okay, so like this. There is no close connection between this possession and its possessor. It is a perfectly imaginary relation when, on account of the great advantage a person derives from these possessions, he says, this is my house, this is my servant, this is my money, and these are my hosts and armies. For when he examines himself, he will find that all these things are external, and their qualities are entirely independent of the possessor. When, therefore, that relation ceases, he that has been a great king may one morning find that there is no difference between him and the lowest person, and yet no change has taken place in the things which were ascribed to him.
Okay? The philosophers have shown that he whose sole aim in all his exertions and endeavors is the possession of this kind of perfection only seeks perfectly imaginary and transient things. And even if these remain his property all his lifetime, they do not give him any perfection. That's the first thing. The second kind is more closely related to man's body than the first. It includes the perfection of the shape, constitution, and form of man's body, the utmost evenness of temperament, and the proper order and strength of his limbs. In other words, physical perfection, physical health. Okay? This kind of perfection must likewise be excluded from forming our chief aim, because it is perfection of the body. And man does not possess it as man, but as a living being. He has this property besides in common with the lowest animals, and even if a person possesses the greatest possible strength, he cannot be as strong as a mule. Much less can he be as strong as a lion or an elephant. He therefore can at the utmost have strength that might enable him to carry a heavy burden or break a thick substance. So he used to have a... Or do similar things in which there is no great profit for the body. The soul derives no profit whatever from this kind of perfection. So, the third kind of perfection, he said, is more closely connected with man himself than the second perfection. It includes moral perfection, the highest degree of excellency in man's character. Most of the precepts aim at producing this perfection. But even this kind is only a preparation for another perfection and is not sought for its own sake. For all moral principles concern the relation of man to his neighbor. The perfection of man's moral principles, as it were, given to man for the benefit of mankind. Imagine a person being alone and having no connection whatever with any other person. All his good moral principles are at rest. They are not required and give no perfection whatever. Okay? These principles are only necessary and useful when man comes in contact with others. Then the fourth kind of perfection is the true perfection of man, the possession of the highest intellectual faculties, the possession of such notions which lead to true metaphysical opinions as regards God. With this perfection, man has obtained his final object. It gives him true human perfection. It remains to him alone. It gives him immortality, and on its account, he is called man. Examine the three kinds of perfection. You will find that if you possess them, they are not your property, but the property of others. According to the ordinary view, however, they belong to you and to others. But the last kind of perfection is exclusively yours, he says. No one else owns any part of it. They shall be only thine own and not strangers with thee. Your aim must therefore be to attain this fourth perfection. That is exclusively yours. And you ought not to continue to work and weary yourself for that which belongs to others, whilst neglecting your soul till it has lost entirely its original purity through the dominion of the bodily powers over it. Okay? The same idea.
There are many difficult points in this Rambam, but we are just going to deal with one. And that is, at the end, why this exhortation to be concerned only with that which is only yours, and why this last perfection is considered only yours. Of course, we understand that the Rambam is saying that this is the greatest perfection. The way he formulates it is yours, and why then the exhortation, you should only concern yourself with that which is yours. What does he mean by this idea of yours? He should have said that which is perfection in man, that which belongs to man, is the intellectual perfection. Fine.
We were talking about the Rambam in the end of the Mora, where he mentions the four kinds of perfection. And the four kinds of perfection are, the lowest, he says, is perfection of one's estate, one's possessions. The next in order is one's physical body. And the third kind of perfection is the midos, characteristics. And the highest, he says, is the intellectual. The highest is the intellectual. I mean, I'm not going to deal with all the problems here. We've mentioned once before, maybe more than once, the answer to the question how the Rambam can include perfection of midos. He says perfection of midos is not a real perfection. And yet at the end of the Mora, he says it's the highest level. Where a person does good to his fellow man, that is the highest level, the Rambam says. And over here he says, if you were all alone, you wouldn't need it, and therefore it's not considered a perfection. We've spoken about that at least once or twice before, so I'm not going to go into that problem. But the question that, first of all,
It's an interesting, you have to understand the way the Rambam formulates. And the formulation of the Rambam is dependent upon his way of thinking, which is a little bit different than people today think. I mean, it doesn't matter precise way of thinking that most people aren't familiar with, and that's why a lot of things seem a little out of line. But for instance, if you take the first class of perfection, so he says, so he starts off, he says, the first kind, the lowest, in the acquisition of which people spend their days, is perfection as regards property. Okay, possession of money, garments, furniture, servants, land, like, possession of the title of a great king belongs to this class. He means honor also. Then he goes on, there is no close connection between this possession and its possessor. It is a perfectly imaginary relation when, on account of the great advantage a person derives from these possessions, he says, this is my house, this is my servant, this is my money, and these are my hosts and armies. Okay? And he says, for when he examines himself, he will find that all these things are external, and their qualities are entirely dependent independent of the possessor. Okay. The philosophers have shown that he whose sole aim in all his exertions and endeavors is the possession of this kind of perfection only seeks perfectly imaginary and transient things. And even if these remain his property all his lifetime, they do not give him any perfection. All right, so they do not give him any perfection. Shouldn't be considered a perfection. Degree, and therefore you can't simply say, did he use it as a means? I mean, to what degree? To what degree he used it as a means? So different degrees. That's how man perfects himself, by degrees. It's an interesting thing that that it's a quantitative. Man's perfection is always on a quantitative scale. Quantitative scale. So insofar as he uses it as a means, so then it's a perfection, you're saying. But insofar as he used it as an end, it's not a perfection. So then I wouldn't classify it as a perfection altogether. Why does the Rambam classify it as a perfection? Depends on how you use it. It's not a perfection, really. You're not going to classify every means for perfection, are you? The answer is that the Rambam means by perfection bringing to fulfillment, bringing into actuality something which is related to man. That's what perfection means. By perfection he means something which is related, which is in the group of objects that's related to man in some way, you see, bringing those things into a state of actualizing, fully bringing into a state of fulfillment those things, perfecting them. So you bring them to their state of perfection. One second. Now, what the Rambam means is like this, that when you take a look at all the things that are related to man, all those things that are related to man, so you'll find that they're broken down into four categories. You see? There are man's possessions. Then there's man's body. Then there are his characteristics. And last is his intellect. Okay? Now, when Rambam means bringing into a state of perfection a person's estate, he means when you take this group of objects, you could break down the relationship between man and his objects. The categories of objects actually are broken down into four. But in perfection, he means bringing to fulfillment, perfecting that group, whatever group that might be, bringing it to its perfection. Okay? Now, certainly there is no question that man has a concept. There is such a thing as man's possessions. I mean, it exists. You can't say the idea of man's possessions does not exist. It exists in actuality. So possessions are related in some way to man. It's a different relationship than his body, for instance, but it is some relationship. And perfection means bringing that thing to its ultimate fulfillment. That's why the Rambam, when he speaks about the body, for instance,
He says no matter how much a... even if a person possesses the greatest possible strength, he could not be as strong as a mule, much less can he be as strong as a lion or an elephant. See? So, what is the Rambam... Why does the Rambam talk in those terms? What is he talking about? He can't be as strong as a mule. What the Rambam means is taking that group, that category, and pushing it to the nth degree that it could ever attain. See? So he speaks about taking the category of the body and pushing it to that. That's a perfect... Perfection means when you take that category and you push it to its final goal, that's perfection. Perfection means when a thing reaches its final ultimate goal. So the Rambam says there are four categories of objects that a person can reach, that have a goal, and that this goal can be attained. That's what perfection means. Perfection means when that category reaches its ultimate goal. Okay.
Look at the problem with it.
That premise is necessary in the Rambam. You can't do it without that premise. You wouldn't understand what the Rambam means by perfection. Okay. Yeah. The perfection over here, the Rambam is not referring to the person. If he was referring to the person, so then it wouldn't be necessary to tell you what perfection is in the person. That, however, is the question. Why didn't the Rambam? Most people, when they speak in terms of perfection, you see, when they speak in terms of perfection, they usually speak about what are the things that really make a person perfected. Nobody, like I said, would include money. I don't think anybody in the wildest dream would get up and give a drusha and say that we have to have more money, that's perfection. You see, or we have to be physically stronger. I mean, maybe in terms of health, but basically I don't think anybody would really speak like the Rambam does and say that we have to now try to increase the size of our muscles. I mean, nobody would consider that as perfection, because we don't break it down that way. We speak in terms of what are the underlying features that are involved in man's perfection. And we certainly recognize it's something internal and whether it's emotional or intellectual, whatever it is, but we recognize that it's something, that perfection is something deep inside of us and not something that's external. But the Rambam breaks it down in a strange way, you see. The Rambam breaks down in a strange way, in these strange categories. First he says, like we said before, this is a perfection, and then no, this is total imagination. Then the body, great perfection, wonderful, strong as a mule, no good, doesn't do anything for it. Midos, fine, perfection, wonderful. Doesn't help you any. The only thing is intellectual. It's a funny kind of a break. I'm telling you how he's working. But the way he's working is, you see, I'm telling you the way he's working. Why he's working that way is the next step. Why does the Rambam really break it down that way? Why does the Rambam say by perfection, what the Rambam means by perfection is, like I said before, it means taking a category of objects. You see? And perfection means bringing these objects to their ultimate aim and goal. Their greatest, fulfilling their greatest potential. That's what perfection is. Now what the Rambam says is that there are four different classes of objects that in man can be, we could speak in relationship to man as being brought to their ultimate goal and their ultimate perfection. Right? Why does he do it that way? That's the question. Why does he do it that way? And why does he have that exhortation at the end where he says that, not only does he finish defining, he says, okay, says the main thing is the last kind of perfection is exclusively yours, and then he tells it, he says, and you shouldn't waste your time going after the other things, because they're not yours. I mean, it's a funny, what does he need this whole exhortation? You want to tell him what the greatest perfection is? It's intellectual perfection, fine. Now what is this, like a different mussar? This is really yours, you should go after this, and... What do you mean it's yours? What does yours have to do with it? There's something funny here in the Rambam. What Rambam maintains is that, and it's philosophically correct, but what he maintains is that a person recognizes that the only thing really that is worthwhile going after is something which is yours, which is exclusively yours. Every person recognizes that. That's an underlying feature in every human being. No matter what he chooses, see, He recognizes, the reason why he goes after something is because this is his. The thing is, what the Rambam maintains is that there are, that's why the Rambam breaks it down in terms of four classification of yours. Four classifications of yours. You see? Now, he shows, that's why he breaks it down that way. Because really what a person is after is, like I said before, is something, he's after something that he feels, that he, it's human nature. Man's nature is such that he will go after that which is his. And his perfection has to lie in that activity, in going after something that's his. There is no one in the world that can go after perfection in terms as an altruistic endeavor. It's impossible. Person goes after what's his. Even if he should maintain that being good to others is good, but he'll always maintain it's good, and it's, therefore it's good for him, and that's why he's doing it. Okay? Otherwise, he has no mode of operation. Why should he do it? No matter what the sheet is, there's always a benefit, some benefit in the back of the person's mind. There's always some benefit that he will attain it, he will attain from it. And he goes after those things because of the fact that is that these things are to his benefit. In order for something to be of benefit for you, to be of your benefit to you, there has to be some type of acquisition. I mean, there has to be some type of attainment. So whenever a person goes after something, there must be a concept of attainment there. Now, what the Rambam says is that if you take a look at the things, that you take a look at the realm of, at the area, the whole realm, the gamut of those things which man can attain, you'll find they could be broken down into four categories. The four categories are first the possessions, then the physical, then his psychological perfection, and then his intellectual perfection. Every one of these things is considered an attainment. Okay? That's the reason why the Rambam breaks it down that way, is because the Rambam is operating under the concept of attainment. You see, attainment is the concept, is a necessary concept for perfection. Because perfection has to involve some kind of attainment. Now, since attainment is the category for perfection, that's the basic premise of the whole Rambam over here, that perfection has to involve some kind of attainment, so the Rambam says, therefore, we have to break all the attainments in the world down into four groups, and into four. And then we'll be able to see which attainment is the real attainment. Okay? That's really the order of the Rambam. Now, things like this. Again, getting back to the premise that every person functions based upon the fact that he desires something, he wants to attain something, what the Rambam says is like this. The difference between a person that really finds happiness and really finds the true life and a person that doesn't really find the true life is a very simple thing. You could put it in simple terms. He makes a mistake with regard to what attainments are. It's a mistake. Simple error. See? That's why the Rambam, for instance, when he takes the first category, it's true. There's a category of attainment. Possessions. But the Rambam says the man makes a mistake. The mistake that he makes is that he really thinks that he has a real possession here. If a person would ever think that there is no real possession, he would never go, he couldn't possibly go after that. Because it would be ludicrous. He'd think to himself, what do you mean? What do I have? Nothing. So the answer is, a person who, like the Rambam says, philosophers have shown that he whose sole aim in all his exertions and endeavors is the possession of this kind of perfection only seeks perfectly imaginary and transient things. The premise of the Rambam has been laid down, which is that perfection must be some kind of attainment. And a person, another premise is that every individual always wants, is by nature, really, wants perfection and wants attainment. So the only difference between a person who truly reaches perfection and one who doesn't, isn't, or let's say not reaches, but seeks real perfection, or one who seeks something which is not perfection, is a mistake in terms of attainment. It's a mistake. The mistake is the person thinks that this is a real attainment. It is an attainment. We have to, if we want to break it down logically into the group of things which are attainments, it is an attainment. You can't say there's no such thing as human possessions. It's an attainment. But what kind of attainment is it? It's completely an artificial societal structure. So therefore, while such an attainment does exist, we can't deny its existence, the nature of the attainment, insofar as man is really concerned, is non-existent. It's an artificial external type of attainment. But nevertheless, what the Rambam is trying to show you is that those who spend their days, like he says, whose sole aim in all his exertions and endeavors is the possession of this kind of perfection, he says, is in the world of total imagination. What does he mean? He means to say that the man has made a mistake, a very simple mistake insofar as attainment is concerned. It's a logical mistake. He made a mistake. But this mistake could last a person's lifetime. Once a person makes a mistake, he doesn't usually try to rethink in life. I mean, he gets set in one way, and there he goes. That's it. Shuvah is a very nice mitzvah, but it's not really done too often. So, therefore, the mistake that he makes could last a lifetime. But the Rambam says, nevertheless, it's still logically, intellectually, it boils down to a simple mistake. That's a mistake. The second group, the physical also. The second group, the physical also. And there are people like that as well, whose aim in life is to be physically strong. So he says again that this is again the person who does that. The person who does that, and you can see today, the person who's involved in health, and the person who really is after his physical well-being, will maintain that this is important, more important than anything, because this is him. This is him. He has a better argument actually than the person who's after wealth, because he could show you physically. I mean, everybody knows that if you're sick, I mean, everybody says that as long as you're healthy, right? So therefore, this a person readily perceives as being more important. So, but those people who do that with their idea, the concept behind it. You see, the Rambam is showing you what the motivation is. What is the motivation? The motivation is that this is really him. This is really him. And I'll tell you, I mean, I have a physical body, I mean, it's me. So this is more important than anything else. Then he has the third group. The third group is really the psychologists. Today, psychologists would fall into the third group. Psychological health. The physical doesn't matter. What difference does it make, the physical? The main thing is if you're happy inside. And everybody knows that you cannot be happy inside unless you're psychologically well. So you could have possessions, you can be physically healthy, or you could still sit here in your beautiful home and be miserable. Everybody knows that. I mean, that's a better argument, actually. I mean, even people even recognize that. The main thing is to be happy. So if you're psychologically disturbed, so you realize that everything that you have, you could have your health, but what good is it? Right? I mean, if a person is bogged down by compulsions and really doesn't have too much freedom in his activity, so well, what kind of happiness does he have? He's neurotic. I mean, he's eating himself up inside, and he doesn't have as much happiness as a person who is psychologically well, might not have any possessions, might not even be that healthy. He's in a wheelchair, but he's riding in the park and he's enjoying a beautiful day. He's having a great time. So therefore, what the Rambam says is that this argument, I mean, is if you think rationally, most people don't live that way, but rationally, if they think about it, they come to that conclusion right away. Nobody can argue with that. Nobody can argue with that. So there, the argument would be that the reason those who seek, the psychologists who maintain that the health of the individual is the mental health is the most important thing, Their argument is, what is their argument? That this is really you. You see, each person's argument, the Rambam says, is always the same. The argument is, it's you. And a person functions and works only because of one thing. Because of the principle that he feels that whatever attainments he has, are really a part of him. That's the way a person works. Since that's the underlying premise, that's why the Rambam breaks it up and breaks it down into four categories. And that's why the Rambam says, but in the end he says, but you're making a mistake. He says, there is only one thing that is really you. It's not the possessions, it's not the physical, not even the psyche. It's not even the personality. No, not even the personality. There's only one thing. That is the intellect of man. That is the mind. That is the only part that is really him. And therefore, the Rambam says that only perfection in that area is really, truly an attainment. That's the only real attainment. And that is the only way that a human being can really be happy. This is the only thing that's really his. But I want you to understand something. The thing is, see, there's something here that's very important. Why the exhortation? Why does the Ram give such an exhortation? Ram doesn't give an exhortation like this. Ram wasn't. It's not a Musa book. It's a book of philosophy. Why does Ram give an exhortation where he says at the end, he says, and you shouldn't follow the other things. Make sure that you go after this because this is really yours. What is the exhortation? The exhortation is necessary because of the situation. You see? The situation is such that a person, the reason why people do all these things, why do people run after the false things? Why do they? I mean, you see constantly, all the time. And you see, as soon as things don't work out their way, right, the first one to admit, oh, I want to have my health. Huh? A person will have psychological problems. They'll say, yeah, the main thing is that you feel inside. People recognize these truths at different intervals. Usually they're intervals of mishap. Not really intervals where a person is in his usual frame of mind. The reason is like this, the Rambam. The reason is like this. And that's why the Rambam gives the exhortation. The reason is because a person is raised to believe. See, there's a certain effect that society has on him, his parents, society, and the way he was raised is geared. Man is subject to... man is subject to taking in values, external values, being imprinted, so to speak. And since man has a part of his mind that lends itself to that process, so what happens is that people who go after these other things, the reason is, to a large extent, because they've been raised that way, because society says that way, they've been taught by others that this is really yours. And that's why the Rambam says, but it's not really yours. That's why the Rambam gives the exhortation. The exhortation in the Rambam is given for one purpose. He's trying to counteract a very strong influence that exists in this area, and he simply couldn't leave the area without counteracting that influence, because it's the most powerful influence. That influence is that you've been taught to believe, you've been imprinted, and you've been taught to believe that this is really yours. These things are yours. Since you've been taught that way, you see, the man's drive is really good. The drive is to go for attainment and perfection. Everybody wants that. No question about it. Nobody wants to be imperfect. The only thing is that people make mistakes. And what the Rambam maintains is that most of the mistakes, the reason why people make most of the mistakes, is because of external influences. Others have told you that this is yours. But if you think into it really, you'll see that it's not you even that maintains it's yours. But it's others. There's something in your mind which is always reflecting society or parental values or whatever influence you've absorbed. You see, those influences are always there. And if you'll think about it and you'll analyze it, you'll see that those things are not really yours. They don't really belong to you. There's something from the outside that has been projected onto you, and that's why you maintain that these things are yours. But they really aren't yours. And the Rambam gives the exhortation simply because it's necessary in discussing this area. You see, you can't leave the area without really discussing, mentioning the most important influence against perfection that exists in man. And that's why the Rambam gives that, he gives that exhortation. Don't be fooled, he says. Don't be fooled. These things are not really yours. You think they're yours. Think about it. It's not yours. Others. You're working for others. Other people, all those people that in the back of your mind, you're trying to satisfy their value system, which is important, you're working for them. You're not working for yourself. You're not working for yourself. That's what the Rambam says. And it's a pasuk. It's a pasuk in... It's a pasuk in Shir Shirim. The same idea is expressed in the beginning of those poems which allegorically represent the state of our soul. Shir Shirim. My mother's children were angry with me. Bnei mi nicharuvi. Samuni, they may be the keeper of the vineyards, but mine own vineyard I have not kept. What does it mean? It means that I've been influenced by others to look for the value system. Not that he actually worked for others. Nobody's going to be a fool, going to work and spend his life working for others. Why should he do that? The answer is, he is working for others in a strange sense, in a sense of the soul. He's working, he thinks he's working for himself. But really, actually what he's doing is, he's trying in the back of his mind to make others happy, so to speak. He's been impressed with the, he's trying to satisfy, what would they say? What would they say? This is the value system. It's a false value system. He is working unconsciously for others. And that's what he's spending his days in, you see. And the truth of the matter is he's neglecting his own happiness and his own soul. That's how the Rambam explains that pasuk. Kami shali lo natarti. That's what the Rambam says. So this Rambam is an unbelievable Rambam. He shows you precisely what perfection is and where. Right, where the loophole is that people always go through, you see, and never really make it to perfection because of that loophole. That loophole is that little trick that the person makes a mistake in thinking that he really is working for himself. Actually, in the back of his mind, he's trying to satisfy a certain system. See, people, by the way, I mean even religious people. And I've heard people say, for instance, the reason why I'm religious is because my father was this way, and his father was that way, and I'm that way too. And I'm going to be that way too, and my kids will be that way. It may sound very nice, but it's ridiculous. Because what the person is saying is that if his father was did something nonsensical, that was his. What he's saying is, that expression is really, Samuni no teras akramim, karmi shali lo natarti. They already set up the value system. I've absorbed the value system, you see, and I'm going to work into the end of my life to satisfy the thought behind everything he does, is the thought that his father will say that this is really the right way, you did a good job, see? So who's he working for? He's working for others, not working for himself. He thinks he's working for himself, but in actuality, unconsciously, he's working for others. That's why the Rambam gives such an exhortation. The exhortation is because it's the most prevalent cause in the corruption of a person and in preventing a person from reaching perfection. That is the most prevalent cause, the most powerful force. It's an interesting one, huh? Without a Marishan. How it got started and why man is that way is, I mean, that's a different study altogether. But the Shir himself. But the Rambam is just telling you that man is that way and he's warning you. Don't waste your life, because a person can go through his whole life, will never achieve the perfection or the happiness. In the back of it, he's driven by certain thoughts that lie in the back of his mind, in his subconscious mind. But he'll never really stop to analyze them. And if he doesn't stop to analyze them, he'll be driven by them all his life. And that one mistake will simply, his whole life could be summed up with one little mistake. That's what Ram when Ram saw this, it's a shame. I mean, how could such a thing happen? That's why he had to give that exhortation. Don't be a fool. Don't do it. That's right. Don't be fooled. Thing. I mean, it's the average person is a mixture. Ram just mentions absolute terms because the philosopher always speaks that way. It's easy to understand it that way. But the truth of the matter is that it's an interesting thing. But as you go down the scale, the emotional pull gets stronger. As you go down the scale, the emotional pull gets stronger. It's an interesting thing. Why? Or in society, society certainly has that, is in that direction. No question about it. The most The most exciting, the most exciting features in society, the most exciting parts of society, are definitely in the lower rungs of the. As you get lower, gets more and more emotional attachment to it. And that definitely is a big factor. Definitely is a big factor. Why society should be that way is a question. Why is all society that way? Then you have to have, there has to be something at the bottom that has to do with the man's nature. But the societal effect is a very, very great one. That's what the Rambam is discussing. The Rambam, that everybody's after one thing, and that is attainment. The only thing is some people make mistakes, and the biggest cause of the mistakes is the influence that we have from others. We work for those others that influenced us. In the back of our minds, we work for those others that influenced us. That is the biggest cause of error. A person will get dressed to go to an affair. Now, why does a person dress himself up to go to an affair? If you think about it logically, it's ridiculous. Why should I have to get dressed so somebody else, if I look nice, that what does mean look nice? Look nice means that somebody else will find it satisfactory to look at me. So find some satisfaction in looking at me. It looks pleasant, right? Well, why do I have to be so concerned about his satisfaction? Suddenly I became such an altruist. Well, what is the answer? The answer is that the person feels there is some kind of attainment that he has. He has some kind of attainment in the fact that he can that he dresses well. He is a good dresser. What does he is a good dresser mean? It's not the action. He is a good dresser means that there's some part of him which is being perfected. That is the idea behind every action, that there's some part in the person that's being perfected. And as ridiculous as it may seem, you see, he will still buy it. He'll still buy it. That's what it was. That this is false. Once again, what the Rambam is doing is the Rambam is showing you that every person is after attainments. And then he says, what are the attainments that man can, that person can have? Now you can't say that possessions is not an attainment. To say it's not an attainment is false, because it is an attainment in some kind of a sense. That sense that it's an attainment, whatever it might be, might not necessarily be the type that you think it is, but it is some kind of attainment. So he says it is, but it's an artificial attainment. Some accidental relationship between the possessions and himself. There is some. It's an accidental relationship, and it is a perfection because it does relate to him in an accidental way. So we have to classify it under attainments. Man can really be happy is where he does things that are truly for himself. He's involved in those things. Then he'll truly be happy, because everything he's doing is going to really make him happy. So he's really going to make him happy if he can do that. It's a natural thing. The only way he's going to be happy really is by doing things which are really giving him the benefit. Something which gives somebody else the benefit, not him, he's going to be unhappy. See, now if he works for a phantasm in the back of his mind, so he's really, he's not really satisfying himself. He's only satisfying that one part of his mind. That one part of his mind will never make him happy, because it's not really him. It's only something which was introduced later as a mechanism that exists within him. But he himself can never be happy, because he's not really doing anything for himself. Then he sees he's unhappy, so he figures maybe he's not doing enough for that part of the mind. He'll learn further. It's a mistake. It's an error. The Rambam was under the opinion that really all imperfection in man is a mistake. Just mistake. That's all. Logical error. As the question was raised, the Rambam over here just says that you should, exhort you to do things for yourself. But how do you do things for yourself? And the only way you'll be happy, obviously, is when you're doing things for yourself. But how do you do that?